about the literature of anguish and despair, about the meaning of evil, how literature has described it and grappled with it, with the question of why there is evil. I would like to make a statement first for the first half of the hour, and then we can open it up to questions and discussion. This is a subject which has a long career in the history of literature. It goes back to the myths of Prometheus and Satan. Various cultures have provided various explanations for evil. In a deeper sense, however, I think that all are variations on a single theme. There has been a great chain of being, as Arthur Lovejoy called it, from Plato to Whitehead. A great chain of being which affirmed the reality of goodness and the non-being of evil. It's a comfortable view. It's a reassuring view. Goodness is there. You can count on it. And therefore you can get away from evil if you have access to the good. In the classic view of life, there was a valiant quest for noble virtue because of this basic belief in the ultimate goodness of being. The ancient myth, to be sure, said that fate is irrevocable. The destinies of men and nations were determined by the stars and the fixity of their periods. Adjustment was therefore the solution to life's sorrow. Even the gods had to bow to Nemesis. And tranquility was sought through apathy, since one could not hope for joy. Peace was not victory, but the cessation of struggle for gods and men. But throughout there was a basic belief in the ultimate goodness and nobility of the real. The ancient myth found expression in the symmetry and balance of the Parthenon, in the peaceful repose of the Apollo Belvedere, in the measured cadences of Aeschylus's choruses. See, everything was ordered. Everything had its place. And this old classic search for equanimity has been perpetuated to this day, not only in the Western world, but in the East, in the Placid Buddhas and the Lissom Kuan Yins of Oriental otherworldliness. In the West, Christianity changed things somewhat, but for the most part, the view that evil is nothing and that reality is good continued unchallenged through Augustine, Anselm, Abelard, Aquinas, Joachim of Flora, Pico della Mirandola, Kant, Hegel, Whitehead, all the way down to the present. Neither the Renaissance nor the Enlightenment questioned the myth. Assurance in the face of both inexorable fate and the wrath of God rested upon the belief in a hierarchy of being with levels of reality corresponding to levels of goodness. See, the more reality you can grasp, the more goodness you have. This is the best of all possible worlds. Now, this common understanding of the reality of goodness and the non-being of evil underlay both the comic sense of life and the tragic. Laughter is evoked over the incongruous. When things are out of place, out of joint, then we laugh. Nothing is so ridiculous as someone pretending to be what he is not. And if he does this without seriousness, it is comical. Like the play last night. Everybody was pretending, not seriously. And so we laughed ourselves silly. But if he does this with an earnestness upon which his life depends, then it is tragic. This is the humor in Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tale of the emperor's clothes. And this is the tragedy of Macbeth. He pretended to be king, and he was not. Seriously. In the Middle Ages, evil was laughed at because it was nothing appearing as something. Artists pictured animals as men and gods to show the comedy of evil. The surrealist paintings of Hieronymus Bosch, with his fantastic absurdities, best illustrate the medieval view of the humor of hell. They laughed Satan out of existence. Shakespeare expressed the medieval view of tragedy in Macbeth, who sins by willing more than he deserved. He destroyed himself by his willful, vaulting ambition, which overleaps itself and falls on the other side, like a man jumping on his horse and jumping too high and falling on the other side. Now this tragedy, through the breakdown of will, is present in both classical literature and its view of life and medieval. But against this long tradition of basic meaning, the modern world is experiencing a breakdown in meaning that is shattering our culture. Men are beginning to say to one another that evil is not an act, neither an absurd lust to be God nor a ridiculous pride to be more than man. Evil is a sickness that is suffered. Not something we do, but something that happens to us, a passion. So it began with the plays of Eugene O'Neill and Tennessee Williams. And gradually, the new anxiety emerged. The anxiety that evil is not the meaningful pretense against the reality of the good, but rather evil is not meaningful at all. Evil is something that happens to us and cannot be explained. So you get all these Freudian psychodramas. This notion has now become the going currency in the marketplace of sophisticated ideas. It was once meaningful to say that evil ultimately originated in the false pretense of a willful person, whether this person was a god or an angel or a man. But now this meaning has been challenged, and it is considered more sophisticated to reject the myths of Prometheus and Satan and the whole hierarchy of beings, and to rest simply, if uneasily, with the acceptance of the meaninglessness of evil. There is something radically new in the contemporary challenge to the traditional system of meaning. The challenge is the nihilism of the good and the meaninglessness of evil. Take, for example, the treatment of death in the modern novel. For Hemingway, death is a cheat. For Conrad, death is a dark enigma. For Melville, death is an exciting, inexorable defeat. In contrast, the old system of meaning said death is deserved. This is what we Christians have always said. Death is deserved. The wages of sin is death. The modern man doesn't believe that anymore. Now, this new point of view, which I have called the nihilism of the good, has come in modern times through the shattering skepticism of philosophers like Voltaire and Hume. It has come through the playwrights like Ibsen and Shaw and Bertolt Brecht. Their plays are more than social satire. Insofar as they attack established custom, their protest may rest upon a deeper sensitivity to what is good than what is generally recognized, and if so, then they are simply still moralists in the traditional sense. The classical myth says that whatever is right, and whatever is good, because what is not right or good is not. But suppose this comes to mean that whatever is right and good because there is no difference between right and wrong, good or bad. Now, this is what Bertolt Brecht seems to be saying in the Threepenny Opera when he has Mac the Knife plead his final cause with a rope around his neck, saying, "What is the difference between a man who robs a bank and a man who founds a bank?" But on deeper reflection, it becomes clear that Brecht is still really making a social protest after all. This is a moralistic challenge thrust at a system which protects public stealing and prosecutes private stealing. A protest as old as the pirate who said to Alexander, "When I rob with a small ship, it is piracy. But when you come with a fleet, it is the heroism of empire." Shades of our foreign policy. But even if we recognize that Brecht's socialism is still resting on traditional morality, we must also admit that his protest is so bitter and so universally directed at every convention that there is nothing left that can be called good. It is this absolute bitterness that foreshadows the new nihilism. And that new nihilism is the final step in the modern breakdown of meaning, which has been made by the avant-garde authors of the so-called theater of the absurd. In addition to bitter protest and withering honesty, authors like Jean Genet, Harold Pinter, and Samuel Beckett have contributed cynical despair. The absurd has often been used in every art form to provide intriguing ambiguity against an ultimate backdrop of meaning. As William Kerr has said, the degree to which a play is ambiguous but knowable in and through its ambiguity is often the measure of our affection and respect for it. But the absurd presented by Samuel Beckett in Endgame, for example, is of a different kind. It is not played against a basic core of absolutes. The purpose of the absurd is not to clarify the absolute, but to assert vapid pointlessness. And this is the new thing that hovers over our culture, the cynical despair of meaninglessness that has broken the great chain of being. In Endgame, Beckett proclaims the pointlessness of life by probing the interior of a man's heart, and his mind and his soul, as he deteriorates in the last stages of his death agony. There are four actors on the stage. They are not characters in a drama. They do not play roles of protagonist and antagonist in the development of a plot. There is tension between them, but nothing really happens. There are no events, and yet the play does move to a climax. The play may be interpreted on several levels, and the measure of its greatness is that it cannot be exhaustingly understood on any one of these levels. Thus, it may be a drama of one man's death, or it may be a Jungian analysis of the psychology of the race, or it may have universal eschatological overtone. Maybe talking about the end of all mankind. On any level, however, it describes the deterioration of life into nothingness. One of the actors, Ham, is blind and bound to a wheelchair. Another, Clove, is bound to Ham as his servant. Ham is sensual, domineering, self-indulgent, untidy. Clove is rational, submissive, servile, orderly. They depend upon each other as the heart and the mind in a complete personality. The stage is a bare room with two small high windows on each side, looking like eyes out into the land on one side and the sea on the other. But nothing happens out there. Even the tide has stopped. On one side of the room are two ash cans, from which occasionally two old people pop up and down. They are the parents of Ham, or maybe his fading memory. Anyway, they are past. And they are discarded like trash. And only occasionally do they intrude to nag and remind us of the guilt of the past. That's the name of one of them, by the way, nag. The climax, if it can be so called, is when Clove sees through the window a small boy coming. Or he seems to be coming. At least there seems to be a yearning for his coming, as if this might maybe be the redeemer of the situation. And now Ham says, it is the end. Throughout the play, the tension builds over the need of Ham and Clove for each other. With the coming of a small boy, Ham says Clove can go. But if he goes, it will mean that he kills Ham, for Ham needs his service to live, and also that Clove will commit suicide, for Ham has the only source of food. But now he can go. This is because Clove sees the boy sitting on his haunches, contemplating his navel. The boy does not come. He does not move. He does nothing. But Clove now sees him in this posture, and it is the symbol of mystic meditation. What does all this mean? Beckett seems to be saying that the only reliefs we can find for the tension between the heart and the mind in the dying soul is when the mind sees what the heart knows, namely, the despair that the only reality is the reality of nothing. When you can turn away from all things, memories of the past, hopes of the future, sensualities of the present, and direct your gaze inwardly into nothingness, then there is peace. The sign of new challenge in our time, which the theater of the absurd brings, is the nihilism of the good. Ancient and medieval man said, there is goodness, and it is real. Evil is the absence of goodness, as dark is the absence of light. Evil is therefore nothing, but good is something. But modern man is saying, there is no light or dark, no evil or good. The pain of the world is ultimate and irredeemable. All is vanity, really vanity. Not as the preacher in Ecclesiastes said, vanity against the abiding goodness and truth of God, but all is nothing against nothing. Maybe this is why people think that they can do anything they want. Now, is this all that can be said? Must we choose between these two myths, the classical myth that goodness is real and evil is nothing, and the modern myth of nihilism? I think not. I say no because I believe it is far worse than either of these say, and far better. There are other possibilities. We can say that evil is something, not nothing, but something, some real positive position, against the backdrop of good, that is also something. The something that suffers, the real evil that is, and triumphs over it. And I think this is the really new word that must be said. It is, of course, an old story. But it is always new, as the history of thought and events and art demonstrates. Evil is not just something that can be laughed at. This is a rational, meaningful view, but it is a wrong reason. Evil is a position. It is not merely pride, nor lust, nor the pathetic absurd. These two can be laughed at, not with laughter, trusting in the victory of goodness, but with the laughter of hollow cynicism. But evil is the horror of rebellion against a person. So it's there. It cannot be just shunted aside with laughter. Cannot be defined in anthropological or psychological terms either, but it can be defined only in theological terms. We must say, because there is another, another with a capital A, because there is another, rebellion against him is real and positive, and evil is both something and meaningful, because good is both something and meaningful. And there is communication in such a world in which evil is something and good is something. There is story. There is real struggle and climax and conclusion. You can't escape from its conflict by a cop-out into a timeless nothing. There is no retreat from the illusoriness of the material world. There is rather the suffering affirmation of the victory of God in his material world. And the material world is hard, and if you kick your foot against it, you'll feel it. Now, this is the message of the Word, the message of suffering action and active passion. The world is the story of the spoken Word, spoken and heard and answered with both yes and no, and with continued conversation, which conquers the no and edifies the yes. The revolutionary novelty of our time is not just a shift in interest from metaphysics to physics, from ghosts in the machine to the machine, from laissez-faire politics and economics to socialism. These pragmatic concerns are characteristic of our age. But when we say that evil is no longer defined as non-being, but as meaninglessness, as our literary artists are doing, and other artists in other fields too, then we are speaking of a radical revolution. We are shifting myths. A new way of looking at life and the world is involved. And man has come to a new cynicism, a nihilistic understanding of himself, which is a threat to his very existence. And so here is where the Christian message, which is both old and new, must pick up its challenge and strike at both the classical myth about being and the modern myth about meaning, and provide something which is real and good and true. Because I think the Christian view gives meaning to being and being to meaning. The modern protest against the rational meaning of the great chain of being, I think, is justified. And it is interesting that this protest comes first and most explicitly from artists. But I think it is too easy just to assert meaninglessness and let it go at that, the way our novelists and playwrights and artists do. Especially it is too easy if this is done out of fatigue and despair because a traditional form of meaning has been found inadequate. One must move on with maturity from the position of doubt to a higher understanding of meaning. And because God has become man in Jesus, man sees himself to be neither the devil's dupe nor God's grim joke, but the beloved creature of God's suffering love. This meaning is the holy humor that sings through sadness as God calls out to God, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" I'm very critical of the literature of our time. Not because it lacks ingenuity, not because it lacks imagination. It's clever. It's interesting. It's exciting. But because it lacks this message of hope. Tomorrow I will be dealing with the literature of hope. And I will want to say that it is not totally lacking. There is much there. But it's so subtle that many people miss it. So I want to talk about that. But the literature of our time is replete with anguish. Now that anguish is honest. We cannot help but be anguished and angered by the world that is thrust upon us, the world that is ours, which we did not choose. So I acknowledge that anguish, that literature of anguish, with thanksgiving. But I say, let's look for something more. Well, I've taken my half hour. Now is your turn.
I wanted to ask you a question about some statements you made just as I came in about the philosophy of good and evil in the Middle Ages. You were saying that, I'm not sure if I got you correctly, but I want to try to understand what you were saying. It seemed that you were saying something to the effect that people in the Middle Ages tended to discount evil. What they worshipped was reality. Mm-hmm. And I've never heard that idea before. And that was kind of playing through my mind, and I was wondering, well what about all the goblins and witches and all of that in the Middle Ages? That doesn't seem like worship of reality, as you were saying, but worship of, well, some kind of super reality or
illusory,
yeah.
a world of illusion. Maybe some of you were here this morning. The discussion of Dale Hayworth, when he was talking about the Dark Ages. It wasn't Dale. It was Rich Kemmerer was talking about the Dark Ages, which weren't so dark. I read in history books when I went to school that there was a long period darkness, in which there was no art, no culture. He referred to that, and then showed a picture of a magnificently tooled gold cover for a manuscript, embedded with precious jewels. Well, the Dark Ages weren't so dark. We're beginning to discover how brilliant they were. These people didn't live in gloom and fear, as we have thought. And their picture of the goblins, I think, is evidence of this. You go to the cathedrals, and what will you see? Gargoyles outside on the parapets. And what was their purpose? The gargoyles were spouts to remove the evil wastes from the roof. And that's the way they laughed at the devil. Inside the cathedrals, there were carvings in wood and stone of angels on the walls and up in the clerestories. But if you look underneath the pews, there weren't pews, but there were chairs and there were stalls here and there. If you looked under those, what would you see? Goblins and witches and oozes and all kinds of strange satyrs and fauns. Devils, spirits trying to be what they are not. And so they were depicted in this humorous fashion. That's the way they laughed at it.
Do you think that
the false pretense?
The dominant culture then did take witches and goblins humorously, or
I think the whole? I think when you say the dominant culture, I'm not sure what you mean, but I would mean by it. I would mean by that the common man, you and me, everybody,
yeah.
The way we live from day to day and what we think of. When we get up in the morning, they didn't live in abject fear of goblins and witches. They laughed at them.
I think that was very true of the peasant folk.
Yes, especially true of the peasant folk.
And expressed through
the
fresco.
Yeah. How do I know? Well, I don't really know this, of course. Nobody can know these things. We can't recover the past, actually. It's lost, like Nag in Endgame. But they pop up once in a while, these old folks. And the memories of the past do give us glimmerings of what happened. And I have a common spirit with my ancestors. There is a common thread that runs through the history of mankind. And so I cannot know this for sure, but I can believe that it is so, that the way I react to these things is the way they reacted. And when I go into those cathedrals and see these goblins, I laugh. And I saw my daughter, for example. She was a little girl of 7 then, on the top of Notre Dame, standing next to one of these gargoyles with her tongue sticking out of it. And so I took a picture of her, and there is the living gargoyle and the gargoyle of stone.
I don't have the impression my mother and grandmother laughed.
Well, some of those old Norwegians didn't laugh very much. Okay, I took a chance looking at your sweater. But even if they weren't, it doesn't make any difference whether they were Norwegian or what the nationality they were. They had hard times, and they may not have laughed as much as they could have if things were easier. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think that...
I don't believe that.
What has come down to me has been quite the opposite of what you're saying. They were not laughing. The forces of evil were very, very real, very, very personal and alive.
Do you think that they are less personal and alive today? Think of the bombing of Cambodia. Maybe we in America don't appreciate it because we haven't been bombed. But I'm talking in cosmic terms of the world.
There must have been some traditions along the line where evil was considered a very strong power. Because I'm thinking of early American literature. I don't remember those men's names, but there are all those sermons of
Jonathan Edwards?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Oh, but
he certainly wasn't laughing at the devil. I don't think. I didn't find it very humorous anyway.
But I think you're misunderstanding. I'm not saying not powerful, and I'm not saying that evil wasn't real to them. It was. That's a psychological reaction we're talking about. You have to make a distinction between the language that I'm using refers to the metaphysics of evil. And now you're talking about the psychology of evil. This is a completely different realm. The psychology of evil talks about how evil was felt, how they regarded it in their hearts. But the metaphysics of evil is the concept of whether or not there was basically goodness in this world, and they believed that. That's what in their hearts they believe. They bet their lives on it. But goodness is real. Evil can be redeemed. You can get away from evil. You can correct it.
Right.
See? In other words, they were not, to put it, maybe this won't help, but it at least codifies it in a phrase, they were not Manichaean. You know what that means?
But what about when the surface is normally real? They show these places where
they even
had
to
throw
their
children down in these wells to appease the evil spirits.
Mm-hmm. Little babies
in those wells.
Sure. I know, I saw that. I experienced the thing in my own compound when I was in India. A Christian woman who was a wife of one of my students jumped into a well so that she could haunt her husband, because her husband wouldn't take her to a movie. And so the students had a meeting, and they sent a delegation to me and asked me if I would buy some black market kerosene so that they could keep their lamps lit all night long, so that that dead woman wouldn't haunt their houses. See, now that's the psychology of evil. It's very real to them.
Sure.
Yes. No, I wouldn't want to be misunderstood on that score. But in contrast to that basic faith in the reality of goodness, today we have a literature which expresses doubt that there is basic goodness in the world. And that has caused deep anguish. A deeper anguish, I think you can see, than even the anguish of these medieval people and these primitive people in cultures other than ours. Yeah. Those simple people that I lived with in India lived a life of robust peasant confidence. They were not half as gloomy as the sannyasis and sadhus and gurus that thought about life. They do. The average peasant in India, they don't call them peasants there, they call them coolies. The average coolie in India is a pretty happy person. He's starving to death, but he's still happy. No, I made that remark many times, that they lack the joy of the Christian, that's for sure. That's right, and the Decameron, too. Robust. Earthy. Yeah, how long can you suffer in sadness? There must come a time when people will grow weary of their own tears. And the spirit of hope is indomitable in the human soul. And I think that there will come a time, yes. But I'm not going to be a prophet trying to predict when this will happen. I think that, as I will say tomorrow, there are seeds of hope in the literature of today, yes.
You think Sorayan is an anomaly?
I don't know Sorayan's plays. The only thing I've read of Sorayan is the Human Comedy. When I read it, I enjoyed it. That was about the time of the Second World War, and I needed that kind of light-hearted lift. But I think he's pretty shallow. Oh, no, I read My Name is Aram. That I enjoyed even more. Those are his earlier works. Yeah, he's an anomaly in that he's shallow. he's not willing to reckon with the depth of the sorrow that it is really here. I think the humor, and there is, I'm not dismissing Sorayan altogether. He has a healthy humor. But if you want a better example of humor in our day, I would point to Charlie Chaplin, who was exiled from our country for 30 years.
Of course, I'm not thinking of
Charlie Chaplin has pathos in humor. It's the kind of thing that to me is real. What is not real is what is simplistic. When you take something and reduce it and take only, you know, you sentimentalize, or it would be just as bad to do it on the other side and present only the tragic. But with Charlie Chaplin, you have the pathos in the humor.
Well, I wouldn't think Sorayan is my favorite author, but I don't think, you know, he's not just telling a bunch of Tom tales. He's what he is trying to point out, I think, is that there is happiness in small little details in life, and that we shouldn't overlook the joy of a boy walking down the road or riding his bicycle or things of this type. Now, it's true, he lacks this pathos, and maybe what you're saying is that an author cannot be truly great unless he blends the two. But I guess I was thinking of the fact that he is an example of a person who doesn't write with a sense of hopelessness.
No, yeah, you're right, and I'm sure this is true. At least I've heard that it is true of his later writings. He has deepened his message.
You mentioned the term psychology and metaphysics. What is your view of the contrast between the two?
Well, metaphysics deals with the nature of reality. It's a philosophical investigation of what is over against what is not. Psychology is an investigation of the behavior of persons and their interactions.
But you know, it seems interesting to me in the face of that definition and what you were saying before is that if looking at evil from a psychological standpoint, people take it very seriously, as several people were pointing out and you seem to agree with.
Yes.
On a psychological level, evil is very real, but you were making the point that on a metaphysical level, it would not.
Yes.
And yet, it seems strange that people would be affected by it psychologically, yet apparently at some deeper level believe that it wasn't really real.
Yeah.
And why would you be
That's
so...
the nature of the anguish.
But why would it... Are you saying the anguish would be deeper if you in fact felt that it was not real, that evil was not real?
Well, I'm saying psychologically we behave on the basis of certain awarenesses, on the basis of our consciousness. But subconsciously, we have a different apperception of reality. And we can break through sometimes, and it's possible, I think, to through literature or through counseling, to break through that membrane that separates the two. And when you do, then you rise to a new level of consciousness. Now that might be, that shock might be terribly painful, but it might be good for you.
Can I ask this question? Despair is always more profound than something happy and joyful. I have a feeling that a lot of these despairing and absurd things are really a put on, especially in modern art.
Yes.
And maybe plays, I don't know as much about them.
Yes.
But it's a great big joke put on by somebody. Maybe these despairing things are too.
Well, I thought that too. Sometimes I get that impression. But I think that we should give them the benefit of the doubt, accept the artist for an honest person, and listen to him when he says what he has to say. I don't think that Samuel Beckett is just pulling our leg. I think he, well, if you can judge by the artist's life, he lives and expresses in his life the pain that he speaks of in his plays. So he
would.
Well, I don't know that much except for the fact that he lives a very ascetic and he's a kind of a recluse and he's not a happy person.
Can judge from his picture.
Yes,
he's
you
like
can.
A very unhappy person.
Just to look at it, any of you have seen his pictures? He's a very lean, gaunt, holy-looking man. He's been an excellent medieval monk.
I've been sitting here wondering. I guess this is just natural of a parish pastor, so you don't get much chance to float in the air, I guess. If the solution, or if you were entering the proper address for this thing is theological, why we sit here using, it seems to me, philosophical categories.
Well, I use the philosophical categories for the sake of analyzing the problem, but I...
What's the matter with theological ones?
The theological solution is the one that I offer. There's nothing wrong with them. I don't think that... maybe I'm not understanding you. I don't think that theological categories and philosophical categories are necessarily antithetical. Theology has, for centuries, used philosophical categories as the handmaid of the gospel. We use that with Plato. We've done it with Aristotle. We're doing it now with Whitehead.
Perhaps in the academic world.
Well, yeah, but the academic world is simply the intellectualization of what goes on everywhere else. These aren't separated. You know, the academic world simply conceptualizes and puts into intellectual language what is happening everywhere.
Maybe you could tell us what kind of language you're thinking.
Well, it just occurred to me that you hit something that I thought was important, but that we were using a language that's quite foreign to that world, that is, we were using philosophical language rather than theological language. And there's a difference to my reference.
Do you mean that someone who was using theological language would not have the same meaning for those words?
As far
like,
as
something
as far
like
as
the metaphysical would be the same.
As far as the Hebrew Christian tradition considers Christian metaphysical language.
Yeah, I think there is a difference between biblical language and the language of philosophy in the Greek tradition. That's true. And I think that some of this use of philosophical language, the borrowing of the categories of Aristotle and Plato, has misled the whole of Western civilization. And so if this is what you mean, I'm in total agreement. In fact, this is what I've been saying. Trying to say.
Yeah.
Not too well. Yeah.
You mentioned that oftentimes laughter comes as a result of observance of an incongruity. Well, in modern times, we had a discussion two or three weeks ago at another conference about that. And we came to the conclusion that some modern literature and some modern motion pictures are bringing out, eliciting laughter in the face of evil and in the face of things of that sort, which was an interesting thing that perhaps modern literature is actually trying to make light of evil.
Yeah, I think I might have not gotten across what I intended to say. I don't mean to say that when we laugh at evil, we're making light of evil. I'm saying that laughter is not something we choose to do. It happens to us. And whenever there is incongruity, we spontaneously laugh. We can't help it. See? This is a difficult concept. What is the nature of comedy and what is the nature of tragedy? Aristotle has a therapeutic theory about it, you know. He said that plays, drama, are to give us release from pity and fear. Man cannot go about his work day by day if he's living in fear, in terror, or if he is in constant pity over some unfortunate situation. He must be released from this by some catharsis, and the function of the play is to do that for him. That's his theory of tragedy. And his theory of comedy is that it releases us from a sense of the ridiculous. You can't live out of joint. And he says the tragic hero is always writ larger than life, so that he is a noble character worthy of our emulation. But the nature of reality is, according to fate, that the tragic character falls in defeat. But nevertheless, in spite of that, we acknowledge and admire his nobility. But the comical character is less than life. And so we laugh at him and avoid emulation. The idea in Aristotle is that art is mimesis, imitation. And you are encouraged to imitate the tragic, noble character, but you are discouraged from imitating the comical figure. Aristophanes pictured Socrates as a figure of ridicule. Everybody laughed at him because he lived up in the clouds.
In the field of recordings, I had what I thought was an interesting experience over in Denmark a few years ago. Quite a few American kids came to our congregation there, which I was serving. And a number of them came with the bottom of their suitcases filled with records. This got to be something I expected. They brought their records with them. And invariably, you know, a bunch of them would have to stay at our home, and they were always welcome, and they'd play these recordings by the hour.
Mm-hmm.
Dirges.
Yeah.
And they would sit in my big chair and soak this up. And I would, once in a while, converse with them about it. And their usual reply was, well, this is for real. I can identify with this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were, in fact, Inuit.
Mm-hmm.
The people of their time.
I think that I've been talking about literature, and what you're saying is that this is equally true in all the art forms.
Then this interesting thing happened. Four of them came at Christmas time. This is several years ago now. And presented me with, for them, quite an expensive gift. They didn't have much money, but they don't take many crowns as an American in Denmark. They presented me with an album of Jesus Christ Superstar. Oh, you must have this, Pat. You must have this. This is really something. It seemed like it was the turn in the road for them. But even though it was, you know, asking the great question, if you really are, and so on. But then at least it was a turn in the road.
I think
the end of the tube, but it was a turn in the road.
I think that might be in partially an answer to Mrs. Quay's question. You're right. I did not see Jesus Christ Superstar on Broadway, nor is it, the movie is out now, and I haven't seen that. I've heard some of the music, and I'm aware of the fact that there is no affirmation of the resurrection in this musical play.
But
they're asking the question, and I think that there is a glimmer of hope there. Same is true with Godspell. I realize that a lot of the more timid and maybe pious Christians are offended by some of the gimmicks and some of the earthiness of these musical plays.
But I think if they could see where some of those kids were,
right,
even the question does for them.
Right. It's where they are, and this at least, and then that's where you've got to go. Jesus, after all, didn't shun Mary Magdalene. He went where she was. And of course, he was criticized for it. Well, my clock says 5 o'clock, and we have to get to supper, so thank you.